Greetings, this is Greg. I want to talk about very early piston engine technology, technology that's been somewhat forgotten since almost the First World War, technology that reduces fuel consumption and increases horsepower through a wide range of aircraft altitudes. During the 15-year period between the Wright brothers' historic flight in 1903 and then through the First World War and beyond, piston engines advanced rapidly. By mid-1918, large displacement V-type engines had become commonplace. So did overhead camshafts, hemispherical, aka Hemi-type combustion chambers, and individual exhaust ports for each cylinder. Engines were getting powerful and, for the time, reliable as well. The U.S.-produced Liberty engine, a big V-12 seen here with a young Hap Arnold, had 400 horsepower in 1918 and post-war would run 75 hours between overhauls, roughly 10 times longer than typical aircraft engines just a few years earlier. Most of these design features continued on into the modern times, but some didn't. It's one of these bits of mostly forgotten technology that's the focus of this video, and that's the overcompressed engine. Overcompressing was used on normally aspirated engines. That means engines without a forced induction device like a turbo or supercharger. Overcompressing allows a normally aspirated engine to make its full rated power from sea level up to some higher altitude. Later, this technology was replaced with forced induction, usually either a turbo or supercharger, which is why overcompressed engines have been largely forgotten. But I think there are important lessons to be learned from them, and as you'll see, this technology is not quite dead. As I know a lot of my viewers are not pilots of piston-powered airplanes, I need to back up a bit and explain the problem the designers were trying to solve, then show how they solved it. In our atmosphere, an increase in altitude causes a decrease in atmospheric pressure and a resulting decrease in air density. There are some obscure exceptions to that with short-term localized weather phenomenon, as well as conditions at very high altitudes. But this isn't a video about the Earth's atmosphere. For our purposes, we can say that air density decreases about 3% with every 1,000 feet of altitude gained. A decrease in air density results in less power from our normally aspirated engine. Again, we're not talking about turbo or supercharged engines. For our purposes, we can say that as a general rule, the power of a normally aspirated engine will decrease by about 3% per 1,000 feet of altitude gained. The reason is simple. The engine needs to burn fuel in order to make power. A decrease in the amount of air it can take in results in a decrease in the amount of fuel it can efficiently burn. It really is about that simple. A 3% reduction in air density means 3% less air inhaled, meaning 3% less fuel can be burned, resulting in, you guessed it, about 3% less power. At 18,000 feet, a normally aspirated piston engine will have lost about half of its horsepower. So that's the problem, a loss of power as the aircraft climbs. Your 200 horsepower engine is down to 164 horsepower at only 6,000 feet. Obviously, this applies to normally aspirated automobiles as well. If you drive from Los Angeles to Denver, you're going to find you have a lot less horsepower available in Denver. The Germans solved this problem to a degree using overcompression. At this point, we have to talk about compression and at least cover the basics. I know many of you already know about engine compression, but please keep in mind we have a lot of new viewers on this channel and people that are new to this stuff in general. In our four-stroke engine, we have the intake, compression, power, and exhaust strokes. I circled the compression stroke. It's the one we're interested in right now. When that piston is on the way up, it compresses the fuel-air mixture. This results in more power than you would otherwise get by burning the fuel. A lot more, and the difference is quite dramatic. Here is a four-stroke piston engine in action. The compression stroke is number 2 in the sequence. Now, I know some of you have seen the Jam Handy film on this before because I've shown it before, but let's look at it again. I really can't come up with a better way to demonstrate the effect of compression than Jam Handy did all those years ago. These two gentlemen are going to demonstrate the power of gasoline when ignited several different ways as compared with gunpowder. Now, initially, this gentleman's just going to pour liquid gasoline right into the cylinder. He's going to strike a match and light it. You'll see there'll be a bit of a poof and then a relatively slow burn. Now, gasoline burns pretty well in this state, but you're not going to propel your car down the road with that. What you need to do is get it mixed really well with the air. So Now they're going to spray a gasoline-air mixture in and light that off, and they're going to compare it to an equivalent amount of gunpowder. I don't know how they determine what equivalent is in this case, but that's what they're doing. Then this is going to be a bigger bang, so they're going to light this off behind the safety of the sandbags, and you will see a pretty big puff. There we go, boom, but a bigger boom from the gunpowder. So this was much more effective than just pouring in the fuel, but gunpowder appears to be much stronger. Now, to measure how much stronger, we're going to fire piston connecting rods out of that short block, using it now as a howitzer, and the gasoline goes about a fourth of the way to number one gunpowder, all the way out to number two, 8 times farther. The gunpowder propelled that connecting rod and piston assembly 8 times farther. That's a lot. Now we're going to add in compression. They're going to get the hammer of science, it's calibrated, ram that piston home to generate compression of that fuel air mixture, and fire them off. Gunpowder goes to two, gasoline goes much farther, about 2 3/4. And that is the power of compression, as demonstrated very well by Jam Handy. So compression boosts power. The amount of compression is largely determined by the engine's static compression ratio, which is a function of the combined volume of the cylinder and combustion chamber when the piston is at the top and bottom of its stroke. If that volume is 10 cubic inches with the piston all the way down, aka bottom dead center, and 1 cubic inch with it all the way up, aka top dead center, then you have 10 to 1 compression. With all other things equal, more compression, or a higher static compression ratio, I should say in this case, means more power. The problem, and there are several problems, but the main problem is that compression is normally limited by knock. As the piston rises and compresses the fuel air mixture, that mixture heats up. At a certain point, the heat will cause the fuel air mixture to ignite prematurely and burn like an explosion rather than a nice rapid burn. Some call this detonation, some call it knock. Either way, it makes a knocking sound, like someone hitting the engine with a little hammer. It's not just an unpleasant sound, though. It can quickly lead to engine failure via a destroyed piston or worse. During the First World War, airplanes were burning fuels which were very susceptible to knock. Aviation fuels would, of course, improve tremendously over time, especially just before and during the Second World War, but during World War I, the anti-knock performance of fuels was very poor. This limited the compression ratio of World War I aircraft engines to around 5 to 1. For comparison, most modern automobiles run at least 10 to 1, often more. Higher compression gives more power, but it also reduces fuel consumption. That sort of makes sense if you think about it. If you can get more power out of a given amount of fuel, that means you need less of that fuel to reach your power requirements for moving your car or whatever it is down the road. For this reason, with all other things equal, if you have two cars going down the road, one with 11 to 1 compression and one with 8 to 1, the higher compression car will use less fuel. So why not build economy cars with ultra-high compression? The problem is that without more expensive premium fuel, the engine would knock. So high compression tends to be reserved for performance cars, as the owners of those vehicles will not typically balk at having to run the more expensive premium fuel. Here's the rub. The high octane fuel is really only needed when the engine is at or near full throttle. At part throttle, there just isn't as much air being compressed. Going down the highway on level ground, a typical automobile engine only inhales about one-tenth the amount of air it uses at full throttle, often less. That means while your engine might have a very high 11 to 1 compression ratio, it's not really compressing very much air, thus knock isn't a factor. Now, when you go to full throttle, it will inhale a big gulp of air, and knock will be much more likely. As there is no way to predict when and if you will need full throttle in everyday normal driving, owners of high compression automobiles usually run high octane premium fuel all the time. In a way, it's a bit wasteful, as all that premium fuel is being burned, but it's really only needed for about 1% of the running. However, an airplane is different. An aircraft engine will run at full power on takeoff and during the initial climb, then it will run a large percentage of its maximum power for most of the flight. It's usually not less than 75% of the maximum power, thus knock is always a threat. That is, until the airplane gets to high altitude. Remember, as the airplane climbs, the air gets thinner. Thus, at high altitude, not as much air is being compressed. Thus, the risk of knock is reduced, much like an automobile cruising down the highway at part throttle. This brings us to the overcompressed engines. There were three which were commonly used. All of them were German: the BMW 3A, the Mercedes D3AU, and the Mercedes D3AV. I'll focus on the BMW engine simply because we have the most information about it, and because it was used in the Fokker D7, a historically very significant airplane. What BMW did is raise the compression of the 3A engine from 4.65 to 1 on their previous engine design up to 6.4 to 1. I realize that by modern standards, that's incredibly low, but in 1917, 6.4 to 1 compression was super high for an aircraft engine. So high, in fact, that with a normal throttle, if allowed to run at full throttle at sea level, knock would be a certainty. In order to prevent engine-destroying knock, BMW used an undersized throttle to restrict the amount of air entering the engine, thus eliminating any chance of knock. Viewed by itself, this would seem pointless. The engine was rated at 185 horsepower on takeoff. At first, you might say, so what? A lot of engines of the period made about the same amount of power by using lower compression engines with bigger throttles. So why bother overcompressing? Here's the trick. The plane had a second throttle, normally closed for takeoff, but it could be opened up as the plane climbed to let more air in and maintain that 185 horsepower all the way up to about 2,000 meters, which is about 6,600 feet. Not only that, but power would actually increase up to that point, and it increases quite a bit. In other words, they were optimizing the compression ratio and total area of the two throttles combined for full throttle at about 6,600 feet. Thus, while competing engines started to lose power during climb right after takeoff, the BMW 3A didn't. By 6,000 feet, other engines had lost 18% of their power, but the BMW 3A at that point had actually gained power. In 1922, the U.S. National Advisory Council on Aeronautics, the organization that would eventually become NASA, did a study on this engine. That study provides us with a graph, which does a great job of showing us just what overcompression does. We want to look at the chart on the right since it shows horsepower. NACA tested the engine at various air densities. To make this easier, I put the approximate corresponding altitudes in there, so this should be easier to follow. I'll darken in the 1600 RPM line, as that's the one for maximum power. Yes, 1600 RPM red line, that's what these things had. And I'll extend the line down to sea level, where the engine makes about 185 horsepower. Now you can see the power climbs from 185 to about 215 horsepower, somewhere around 4,500 feet. That's the point at which the NACA engineers had both throttles fully open. I should point out that I said earlier that the German pilots would fully open the second throttle by 6,600 feet or 2,000 meters. NACA had it fully open earlier. The reason is likely that NACA was opening it as much as possible without knock. The German pilots were probably adhering to a number that was known to be safe for all possible atmospheric pressures and temperatures. In other words, it's real world versus what could be gotten away with in a lab. After peak power is reached, of course, power starts to decrease due to the decreasing air density as the plane climbs. But it's far higher than it would be with a roughly equivalent non-overcompressed engine. For comparison, I'll put in a blue line to represent a typical Allied 200 horsepower V8 of the period. You can clearly see that the overcompressed six-cylinder 185 horsepower engine has a huge advantage over the 200 horsepower conventional engine throughout the vast majority of the altitude range. The 200 horsepower engine has the edge at very low altitudes, but where combat was most likely to take place, from about 2,000 feet up to about 18,000 feet, the overcompressed engine had a big advantage. Not all Fokker D7s had this engine, but the ones that did boosted the reputation of the plane, giving it seemingly impossible performance at altitude. The armistice required that Germany hand over all Fokker D7s, and I think the performance of the BMW 3A engine was a large part of the reason for that. Now, Mercedes also built overcompressed aircraft engines. They were very similar in principle. The big difference was that they just used one standard size throttle and left it up to the pilot not to advance the throttle lever too far until the airplane climbed to an altitude at which it was safe to do so. NACA was impressed by this technology and did continue developing it during the 1920s. In a later report, they detailed their efforts, which included not only the throttling method of preventing knock at lower altitudes, but also pulling back ignition timing, and even by using variable camshaft timing, which is impressive considering this was the mid-1920s. I do have these NACA reports in my Patreon section if you're interested in that sort of thing. Link to my Patreon is in the description. Also, please consider joining my Patreon. Members there do get access to all the research material I use in these videos, plus early access to some videos and more. Oh, and like and subscribe if this type of content is something you enjoy. Overcompressed engines worked. So why did the technology die out so quickly? In a word, supercharging. Supercharged engines came on the scene in a big way in the 1920s, and while overcompressed engines could maintain rated power up to 6,000 feet or so, supercharged engines could not only make far more power, they could maintain rated power up to very high altitudes, 20,000 feet, often much higher. It wasn't long before nearly all military aircraft and civilian airliners were supercharged. What about automobiles? Could this technology have benefited them? Well, first of all, supercharged automobiles were hitting the roads as well. During the 1920s, many of the big-name automobile manufacturers were building supercharged cars. However, the bigger issue is that with a car, there just isn't much need for an overcompressed engine. Few drivers travel, say, from Houston near sea level to Denver at about 5,000 feet on a regular basis. Even when you get to Denver, once there, you're going to find that most gas stations sell slightly lower octane fuel because they know the air is thinner up there, and with a given static compression ratio, the risk of knock is reduced. Thus, even if you had an overcompressed engine in your car, you wouldn't be able to capitalize on it once you got to Denver. Of course, there may be semi-trucks that drive that route all the time, but they're usually turbocharged, which solve this problem another way entirely. That doesn't mean the principle is entirely dead. It's not. It's just implemented in another way. Many modern cars run very high compression ratios, which helps fuel economy. Then, an engine management computer connected to an array of sensors will prevent the throttle from fully opening if it detects knock or thinks that knock is likely. The car's computer will also pull back timing, and many even vary the valve timing, much like what NACA was doing in the 1920s. So modern cars do get away with more compression than they could otherwise use via computer manipulation of the throttle, ignition, and valve timing. So in a way, that's something like the overcompressed engines of World War I. Not quite, but not too far off either. I really hope you enjoyed this video. That's all for now. Goodbye, and have a great day. Oh, and just one more thing. I showed this plane earlier in the video. It's a replica of World War I ace Ernst Udet's Fokker D7. It says low on the side and Dudok nicht on the tail. That means certainly not you. In other words, you might be on my six, but you won't be the one to shoot me down. What isn't well known is the tie-in to the movie The Great Waldo Pepper, which just might be the best aviation movie ever made. It's certainly in my top two, and I change my mind every now and then about which one I think is the best. One of the characters in The Great Waldo Pepper is a World War I German ace named Ernst Kessler. This character is very clearly a fictionalized version of Ernst Udet. Of course, he had to be fictionalized, as the real Ernst Udet obviously never fought the fictional Waldo Pepper. But the clues make it very obvious who they were thinking of. This is the real Ernst Udet. And this is Ernst Kessler, played by an actor named Bo Brunden, who absolutely knocked it out of the park with his performance. So how do I know Kessler is based on Udet? Not only does the actor look like Udet, the plane flown by Kessler is a Fokker triplane that says Lola on the side and Dudok nicht on the tail. In the movie, Kessler says Lola was the name of his first wife. Lo was Udet's nickname for his girlfriend at the time, who became his first wife. Not enough for you? Well, Udet was the highest-scoring surviving German pilot of the war. He was the second highest-scoring German fighter pilot, only after Richthofen. In the movie, Kessler is presented as the greatest pilot in the world, based on his wartime exploits. Kessler, during the movie, toured the country doing stunts and was the first person to do the outside loop, which is fictional, but similar to Udet, who also toured doing stunt flying shows and could do maneuvers no one else at the time could pull off. In fact, in the movie, the stunt pilot does one of the moves Udet was famous for. At the end of the movie, when the credits roll, a vintage picture of Ernst Udet shows up. The Udet-Kessler connection is just a theory, but I think it's a very strong theory, and I for one am convinced it's correct. If you've seen the movie, let me know what you think. If you haven't and you like airplanes, you really should take the time to watch it. Goodbye.